Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. And today marks the first stage in the government's easing of lockdown and hopefully the end of lockdown permanently, with the return of all pupils to school. Isabel, when you compare this with the devolved administrations, Scotland, Wales are opting for a phased return, but Boris Johnson has decided to return all years primary and secondary at once. So is there a risk to this?
Yeah, there is a risk. And the communication from ministers over the weekend has basically been that it's a risk worth taking because children's education is suffering so much as a result of being out of the classroom, not just their education, but also their mental health, their social development and everything along those lines. So there are some staggered starts. I believe that some secondary schools are staggering their starts so they can get the pupils used to testing that they're going to have to do initially in school and then as the weeks wear on from home. And so I don't think all secondary school pupils will be back until next week because of this. But yes, the Westminster administration has taken a different approach to those in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland and so on. And that's part of the contrast there. But if you look at the approach that Nicola Sturgeon's taken in Scotland, she's been much more cautious on other fronts about unlocking as well. And in fact, when I say cautious, she hasn't provided as much detail on what she's going to be doing in terms of unlocking in the way that the Westminster government have.
James, when it comes to mitigating measures, we have the recommendation that secondary school pupils and teachers wear masks where they cannot safely socially distance. But this is only a recommendation, it's not a legal requirement. And then secondly, we have the introduction of rapid mass testing. So all secondary pupils will have 3 tests this week and from then 2 tests a week that they do from home. Some people are a little bit worried about this because of the accuracy of lateral flow tests. Can you talk us through this?
Lateral flow tests are not as good as PCR tests. But the argument is that what lateral flow tests tend to pick up is the people who are most infectious. So the idea is that if you had someone who was asymptomatic but highly infectious, they should be picked up by the lateral flow testing system. I think there was some concern over the weekend about some false positives among lateral flow tests, which are low, but obviously if every secondary school pupil is doing them, a very small percentage of false positives adds up to a reasonably large number of people. And I think one of the controversies is that even if you then take a PCR test after a positive test or a lateral flow test, and that test negative, you would still be expected to isolate based on your positive lateral flow test. I think the interesting question about this return to schools is it is the first test of whether the link between cases and hospitalizations has been broken by the vaccination program or not. I think everyone expects that schools going back will lead to an increase in cases. Previously, there has been a kind of iron link, which is cases go up, then hospitalizations go up, and then eventually deaths go up. The interesting question here is whether the vaccination program is now sufficiently advanced that when cases go up, that doesn't automatically lead to an increase in hospitalizations and then deaths. Because if it doesn't, obviously cases going up is not ideal, but if it isn't going to threaten to overwhelm the health service, it is much, much less of a problem.
And Isabel, where do you think mainstream Tory opinion is on this in terms of the parliamentary party? Because we heard from Mark Harper yesterday that he thinks that the stages should be sped up still. Actually, the vaccination programme is going so quickly that it could move faster.
Yeah, there's still that pressure for the timetable to be sped up and still the threats of unrest in the party if it isn't. But as we've said before on this podcast, none of those threats so far have come to pass. And so you could forgive the Prime Minister for thinking, well, I'm just going to ignore some Conservative MPs who are pushing me to go further and know that they won't actually cause him that much trouble in the long run. And that by the time the restrictions lift, actually those Conservative MPs will largely be quite happy with the way things are, or at least won't mount enough of a challenge to Boris Johnson's authority to cause a problem. I think there'll be debate within the party also on requirements for children to wear masks. Obviously, that's not mandatory, and the testing indeed isn't mandatory either. You can't force a child to take a test. there have been threats from the teaching unions, for instance, that the schools should close again if not enough pupils choose to wear masks. And so you can see some debates within the Conservative Party about how strong the guidance to schools about masks should be. You've got the sort of the pro-mask, pro-restrictions side of the party who'll be saying that their guidance should be much stronger. There should be some more enforcement of this in the same way as it's enforced in supermarkets much more strongly over the past few months. And then you'll have the other side saying, no, what kind of country are we that we're forcing children to wear these face coverings? But amongst all of this will be the unions who, frankly, are looking for more and more reasons to say why the classrooms shouldn't be reopening now.
Now, James, the other row that's been brewing over the weekend relates to nurses' pay. It was not something that Rishi Sunak announced in his budget, but it's quickly become what is seen as a budget story. Now, ultimately, the recommended pay is decided by an independent body, which doesn't announce its recommendation until May, but the Department of Health has suggested a 1% pay increase for NHS workers would be appropriate. How much heat is the government getting for this? Because we've heard of threats from the unions, threats of strike action from nurses, and there's also some unrest in the Tory party over the fact this could be a politically toxic look.
I think the government is getting a decent amount of heat over this. I think voters find it odd that there's only a 1% pay rise being offered to these people after they've done so much work. I think the question of what people think of this really depends on what happens to private sector employment as the furlough scheme comes to an end. If you are in a position where there is large levels of unemployment among private sector workers, I think people will think, well, look, if you work for the government, you know, yes, it's a small pay rise, but you've got a guaranteed job, and that's something worth having. That's a real positive plus. Already, the predictions on where unemployment is going to be at the end of this crisis have roughly halved from the worst case when it was seen as a bit over 12%. It's now seen as just under 7%. If that continues to fall, then I think attitudes to public sector pay might change a bit. I also think, as Isabel pointed out at the weekend, I think one of the big challenges for government is, you know, how do you avoid having kind of long COVID, for example, on things like health service waiting lists and the like? What is the NHS going to need at the end of it to kind of get it back onto an even keel after this crisis? And I think that is one of the big political questions. You've already seen the NHS saying that they need £8 billion now if non-COVID treatment is not going to be impacted. I think this tussle over how much more money the health service needs to get itself righted again after this crisis and this intensity of operation is going to be one of the big issues of the rest of this parliament.
Isabel, this was an issue you touched on in your iColumn last week. When it comes to, I suppose, the problems facing the government in terms of NHS backlog, is there also just a wider issue in the sense that the strong message coming from the Chancellor is ultimately that there has to be belt tightening? They don't use the word austerity, but ultimately there is a suggestion that they're going to be quite careful with spending from here on in. Yet the general expectation among the public and also many in the NHS is that they need more funding, and this crisis has shown that.
I can understand why the Treasury might be reluctant to acquiesce to constant demands from the NHS for more funding. If you talk to anyone who's been a Treasury minister, particularly Chancellor, over the past 10, 20 years, they'll just say that the NHS is always asking for more money and it never ever seems to touch the sides. But I think now is probably the time to have a more sympathetic ear than usual to the health services demands, not least because of the political implications, which could become obvious quite soon. So the warning from NHS providers, which represents hospitals and ambulance trusts today, that unless there is more funding and a better plan for dealing with this backlog and the pressures, then ministers are going to have to start to be honest with the public about the services that the NHS is going to have to cut. Now, if there's one thing we know about all politicians is that they hate being honest about the NHS. So at a local level, you have MPs who will actively campaign against the closure of an unsafe maternity unit, for instance, because they'll have people, and you know, I've spoken to MPs who'll say this, they'll go to public meetings where there'll be people who'll say, I don't care that this hospital is killing people, I want my A&E. The irrational side of the British public's love for the NHS goes through to the way that MPs respond to it, because they're terrified they'll lose their seat. But it goes all the way up to the top, where you have health ministers and prime ministers who are frightened of levelling with the public and saying, well, actually, you are going to have to wait longer. And that means that our cancer outcomes, which internationally already aren't that great, actually, are going to get worse over the next few years. There's another political problem, which is something that those working within the health service are worried about, which is that it would be very easy for ministers to focus on the long-term waiters. So there's about 250,000 people who've been waiting for more than a year for treatment. And that's obviously gone up a huge amount as a result of the pandemic. Now, that's a very politically salient figure to say that someone's been waiting for longer than a year. But if you talk to those who understand NHS waiting lists, they say that to focus on those long stayers would actually cause more of a problem in the long run. And that what they should be doing is focusing on the medium term stayers, which sounds less politically attention grabbing. And so again, once again, we're back into the territory of what works versus what sounds good. And I think we're going to have a lot of that over the next few months. But unless there is a plan and more money and more honesty from ministers, this is going to get far more toxic than just a row about a nurse's pay rise. And I think, just on that, it's fascinating how a pay rise for some NHS staff has become about a pay rise for nurses. And you can just see how much more toxic that is when you start talking about nurses and COVID heroes. So it is a very difficult place for the government to be in on a number of fronts when it comes to the NHS.
Now, finally, James, we've had a tell-all interview overnight with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. Can you talk us through the main claims?
So I think the claim that is making the most running and will gain the most political traction is Harry and Meghan's claim that there was concern in the royal family about what the colour of their baby would be.
And we can hear that clip here.
In those months when I was pregnant, all around this same time, so we have in tandem the conversation of he won't be given security, he's not going to be given a title, and also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
This has got a huge pickup in the States since the interview. And I think the issue here, and this is why I think it's going to become a political question that politicians are going to get dragged into, is it is essentially alleging that the royal family are racist. And that is obviously something that politicians are going to be asked to comment on. You've already had Labour saying today that there needs to be an investigation into this at the palace and what happened. And I think the difficult thing is that if you think about things that are known about this country, the monarchy is one of the most, you know, around the world, if you ask people what they know about Britain, it would be in the top three things that I think everyone would say. Now, it's obviously worth noting that Harry and Meghan refused to name the person who was alleged to have said this. They provide no date for when this conversation was meant to have happened, of the claim. And so this is obviously going to end up being kind of heavily contested. But I think the claim is so incendiary, I find it hard to see how politicians are going to avoid commenting on it. I think it is going to become a big story. And also, internationally, people are going to want to know what the kind of British government thinks of this claim.
And with that in mind, we have a government press conference this afternoon where it could well come up in the Q&A. Thank you, James, and thank you, Isabel.